This book, by the way, is number one in Canada now.
Are you serious?
Yeah, it went to number one within a week. I can't believe it. I'm like you. I doubt the figures, but you know, people keep writing me and say it's number one on the list. So
that is excellent.
Yeah, I'm pretty blown away.
Okay. Hello, I'm Terry McNally, and welcome to Freeform. My guest today compares our current situation in the world to driving too fast along a country road in a dense fog. The car's headlights are like the best experts in forecasting technologies, but they can't make out anything with absolute certainty. Yet, many people act as if they have a pretty good idea where we're going. They see an ever-improving future of broadened and deepened global capitalism, expanded democracy and respect for human rights, marvelous advances in science and technology, all changes that will strengthen our progress toward greater happiness and well-being. So they ignore the fog. They keep their foot pressed on the accelerator. But let's face it. First of all, most of us feel like fairly helpless passengers on this wild ride. And second, we see the news, or maybe on the car radio we hear it, about avian flu, oil shortages, climate change, terrorism. Humankind is doing more things faster across a greater space than ever before, and this is producing changes of a size and speed never before seen. So what is in front of us? Is a deadly crash inevitable? Is that what it will take for us to change what we're doing? Or is there a positive path through the rough road ahead? Thomas Homer Dixon sets out to answer those questions in his new book, The Upside of Down: Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization. Along the way, he points out a number of facts that describe where we are and what's to come, and I'm just going to throw a few of those facts at you. In 1950, there were about 2 poor people for every rich person on Earth. Today, there are about 4, and in 2025, there will be nearly 6. According to UNICEF, nearly half the children in the world are severely deprived of nutrition, water, sanitation, health, shelter, or education. Over 640 million children lack adequate shelter, and every day 4,000 die because of dirty water or poor sanitation. About 40% of the world's population now lacks sufficient water for basic sanitation and hygiene, and nearly 1 out of every 5 people does not have enough to drink. At the same time, the world has 793 billionaires with a combined wealth of $2.6 trillion. Between 1977 and 1996, the weight of the average American cheeseburger grew over 25%, and the volume of the average soft drink more than 50%. Since 1950, industrialized fishing has reduced the total mass of large fish in the world's oceans by 90%. The atmosphere's level of carbon dioxide is the highest in 650,000 years. Saudi Arabia, the world's largest producer of oil, has pumped a total of 46 billion barrels of oil in the past 17 years without admitting to any decrease in its stated reserve figure of about 260 billion. Between 2000 and the beginning of 2005, China's daily oil imports soared 140%. Here on Freeform, we explore the work, the ideas, and the lives of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Thomas Homer Dixon is director of the Trudeau Center for the Study of Peace and Conflict at the University of Toronto. His last book, the national best-selling The Ingenuity Gap, won the Governor General's Literary Award for Nonfiction in Canada, and he tells me that the new book, The Upside of Down, is currently the number one bestseller in Canada. Welcome again, Thomas Homer Dixon, to KPFK and Freeform.
It's marvelous to be here.
Thank you. Now, I like listeners to get to know the people behind the work and the ideas that we're dealing with. So, how do you think of yourself? Are you a futurist, a political scientist, an environmentalist, an economist?
I still have an identity crisis, I think. I find it difficult to put myself in any one category. I'm trained in political science, but I don't really know what political science is. It's certainly not a science. I went into political science simply because it was one place where I could exercise my curiosity and explore a lot of different subjects and issues. So I am radically interdisciplinary. I'm somebody who is constantly moving from one topic to another and trying to see the combinations, the synthesis across the various ideas and topics. I think that rather than calling myself a futurist, fundamentally, I'm just like any other person. I have a 20-month-old son, my first son, and I'm concerned about the future for him. And I'm trying to figure out what might happen and how we can make it better.
Okay. I must say, as I was coming here to the station for this interview, I was thinking about my own fact that I'm also a generalist. How many radio shows even claim to cover that many topics? And I realize that I've said it before, but I feel like I'm a student who is, and a teacher who is teaching while learning. And I feel like you're a teacher who's learning while teaching.
That's absolutely right. I one of the roles I think I play is to try to communicate some of the best scientific research that we have in various important fields, such as in energy or climate change or economics. And I take the findings, which are often difficult to understand for people who aren't in those fields, and communicate them to a wide audience. In the process, of course, I learn a lot about what's going on in these various fields. I always make sure that whatever I write is checked over by experts so that it's as best as possible, it's as valid as I can make it. But I become increasingly informed about the nature of the work in those fields. And also over time, I start to see connections between these various topics, larger patterns. And what I really have in this latest book, I think, is a theory of how societies develop that's taken me several decades to arrive at because of this accumulated understanding, a lot of which has been learned through communicating ideas to the general public.
Right. You heard my intro. If you were to say what the biggest questions driving you right now and driving this book are, what are they?
What are going to be the sources of innovation and adaptation for our societies in the future? Because I've pretty well arrived at the conclusion that the diversity and power of the stresses that we're encountering in our societies and around the world are going to cause some major volatility, some crises, what you might call breakdowns in the future of social and political and economic and technological systems. It's hard to say what they're going to look like. You mentioned the metaphor of the wall of fog. I call that a white wall. We're driving into it at high speed. We don't know what's really even a few feet in front of us, in the sense of we don't know what's even a few years in front of us in the future. So we're going, but we can say that the probability of some major problems developing in the future is probably rising. In the vernacular, I guess you could say that, you know, the wheels are likely to come off at some point. It's unlikely that the future is going to be a linear extrapolation of the present. So the issue then is, what are we going to do in those occasions? How are we going to respond in times of crisis? And that's really the central question I try to address in the book.
And I would say, first of all, I think that the analogy of the car in the fog is even more benign than our situation. In that it's possible you could make it home without a deer jumping in or a car coming into your lane. But I think we know there's an awful lot of stuff that's likely to happen ahead of us.
I introduce another metaphor in the book that serves me well, I think, in thinking about the nature of our world, and that's the metaphor of earthquakes. I talk about tectonic stresses building up under the surface of our societies and of global society. Now, this is something that Californians are very familiar with, having thought about, planned for, and having been afraid of earthquakes for a long period of time. You know, everybody in the state knows that there are these mighty tectonic plates operating and pressing together underneath the state along the San Andreas Fault, among others. And this potential energy builds up, and then at some point it's released in an earthquake that can have devastating consequences. And I think the same is, in a sense, at least metaphorically true for our world. We have demographic, energy, environmental, climate stresses, economic stresses that are building. And at some point, I would expect there will be a release of pressure because our institutions and adaptive capability will be overloaded. We just won't be able to cope.
Right. And as you point out, it's not, you mentioned that it isn't going to be linear and that it isn't that one of these is going to do it. It's the combination and the interaction. But before you respond, let me tell people that you're listening to Free Forum on KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming on the web at www.kpfk.org. I'm Terry McNally, and I'm speaking with Thomas Homer Dixon, author of The Ingenuity Gap, and his newest, the one we're talking about today, The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization. And you can learn more at www.theupsideofdown.com. And that's all four words, the upside of down as one word. And for audios of this and previous shows, you can go to temcnally.livedigital.com/content/audio. You kind of went through them in that answer, but if I may, Jared Diamond puts forth in his book Collapse five factors that have led to collapse. He says it's human environmental impacts, climate change, the behavior of your enemies, the behavior of your friends, and then how you respond to those four. You cite a number of the converging stresses, and again for people.
Demographic, energy, environmental change, especially sort of scarcity of water, shortages of cropland and forests in poor countries, climate, and then finally widening gaps between rich and poor people around the world. Now, you touched on something a moment ago that's very important. The real problem is that they're all happening together. And what we've learned in recent decades and looking at situations where you've had revolution in societies or societal collapse is that it happens when societies are stressed from multiple directions at the same time, when they're having to deal with several problems simultaneously. And that's the kind of situation that we're creating at a global level now. Any one of these problems could be a major challenge for human society. The fact is that we have things going in the wrong direction in five different ways at the same time. And it's really unclear that we can cope, especially since there's likely to be what specialists call interaction effects among some of these things. So, for example, in your statistics before, you mentioned how many people around the world are in a situation of severe water scarcity. That's already critical for many societies and having major economic impacts, causing a lot of poverty and dislocation, undermining institutions. On top of that, if we add climate change, the problem's going to become that much worse. The two things will multiply each other, and you could have really a catastrophic problem of water scarcity in places where, say, the precipitation fails and there's already water scarcity.
And then, as you point out, the energy issue
makes it even worse.
Impacts everything.
Because
moving water.
Right.
Or moving people.
Or drilling deeper into the ground to pull more water out of the ground takes energy. In fact, it's a theme that winds its way all the way through this book. Energy is kind of a master resource. If we have enough cheap, high-quality energy, we can usually cope with a lot of our other problems. But once energy becomes a lot more expensive, then the combination of climate change and already existing water scarcity can be that much harder to deal with.
Yeah, I can remember as far back as the early 70s, which is dating myself, but I did some work with Buckminster Fuller and some of his followers, and I remember that the basic point that some folks made then was that the only true accurate economic value is really related to energy.
Energy, that's right. In fact, there's a whole way of approaching economics that uses thermodynamics. Herman Daly, in particular, has pioneered
Eugene Odom many years
exactly.
ago.
Exactly, Eugene Odom,
and then Herman Daly,
and this work remains as relevant today as it was then. And I use a fair amount of it in the book because energy is a currency that is sort of fundamental and physical, and it gets you away from prices, which often are distractions. Because in the price of something, the price of a barrel of oil, a price of a bushel of grain, there are so many other factors that may not have anything to do with underlying abundance or scarcity of these things.
And I would say the economics of a snail, the economics of a pond, the economics of a chicken, the economics of an entire society, really all of those have to do with the energy that keeps the organism alive.
Right. And now all of those things are what physicists would call far from thermodynamic equilibrium, which basically means they're complex systems that require a lot of energy, constant input of high-quality energy to maintain that complexity. What human beings have done is they've created cities and societies that are extremely complex, technologies that are extremely complex. That's wonderful. We use those things to solve our problems and to raise our standard of living. But it also takes enormous inputs of high-quality energy. Think about Los Angeles, the city we're in right now. The energy footprint of this of this city is hundreds of times larger than the city itself. The question is ultimately whether we can sustain that indefinitely, especially since we're probably moving from what you could call a petroleum age to a post-petroleum age, where energy is going to become steadily more expensive. It's going to become steadily more expensive in terms of the amount of energy that it takes to produce energy.
That's right. As people who've heard this show consistently know, we've talked about peak oil a number of times. And if you say it to someone and you don't tell them it's a bad thing, when we've used up half the oil in the ground, they would say, my God, only half in 100 years?
No, we still have a half left.
But what we have, every single barrel from now on
is harder to get.
Harder to get. And we've gotten the easiest half.
That's right. It takes more energy to get. And then if we look at oil-producing regions around the world, mature oil-producing regions or oil fields, once you pass peak production in the field or the region, the decline can be quite rapid. It can be 3% at least a year, but in some places, for instance, in Oman right now, the major oil field in Oman is declining 12% a year. A lot of the fields in Texas decline at the rate of 12% a year. The North Sea field that the UK depends upon is declining 8% a year. That's a very rapid shift from increasing production to decreasing production and a shift into a world of scarcity. When we pass the peak in global oil production, prices will change dramatically very quickly, energy prices.
And one of the things that I'm just going to throw it out there, you don't even have to respond to this, but remember this, folks, our current way of feeding ourselves in America is everything on your plate averages coming 1,300 miles to get there. This is an unsustainable way to feed ourselves, yet we've rigged all of our economic systems and our agricultural systems toward that as if energy would never run out.
Here's a statistic that I came across in writing this book that really astonished me. So we've quadrupled the human population in the last century from 1.5 billion to 6.3 billion, in part because we've had a lot of cheap energy. And in particular, that cheap energy has allowed us to increase the amount of energy in our food production systems by 80-fold. 80-fold. So
it takes 80 times more energy to feed those four times more people.
That's right. Exactly. And so we've created a system, a food system, water system, cities that are fundamentally dependent upon a resource that is not indefinitely available.
Right. And when I said that about food, what I also mean is the whole idea of free trade, which basically has this globalized exchange, which depends usually on long distances.
That's right. Now, you know, we've heard about Thomas Friedman and his book, The Flat Earth, right? That we're moving to a frictionless global economy where everybody can compete on an equal plane. But that's only the case if we have abundant, cheap energy.
Yes, it would have been the high point had it come 50 years ago. Sort of when we still have the cheap energy.
It's actually going to be the case that as energy becomes more expensive, people will start moving their production closer to the consumers. It won't make sense to have your production facilities in China if you're selling your goods in the United States. You're going to want them back at least on the Mexican border.
Yeah, it's going to be this weird, like playing a film backwards in a way to save ourselves. Let me ask you before you answer. I'm gonna make one more reference to Jared Diamond, and then I want to turn to the unique aspects of your book. In other words, the litany of crisis people have heard, but what's unique, I think, is the stance you're willing to take about what's going to happen. Let me just say that Diamond says that there are two main choices we have to make to succeed rather than collapse, given that the factors of collapse are all at play right now. One is long-term thinking. What he's saying is the societies that thought long-term and that were willing and flexible enough to change their values when they no longer serve them. So how do you feel about those two, and what do you feel are the things that will save us from ourselves? Or to put it another way, what is the upside of down?
Well, I agree with Jared on both those factors. I think they're both important. And in fact, at the end of my book, I spend a fair amount of time talking about the importance of value change, moving away from what I call strictly utilitarian values, which focus on simple likes and dislikes that emphasize, for instance, consumption of material goods, towards moral values and even what I would call existential values, which relate to what we consider to be the good life, what brings meaning into our lives. What kind of world do we really want for our children and our children's children? We don't have that conversation for the most part, and they're fundamentally value conversations. My difference, I think, with Jared Diamond is that I don't think we're going to really begin those conversations in a proper way until there are some difficulties in the future, some crises or breakdowns that are arising from the stresses our societies are under. In other words, my impression of Jared Diamond's argument is that collapse is something we have to avoid in all cases and in all forms. On the other hand, what I say is that there are various forms of collapse. Therefore, you can sort of think of a continuum or a spectrum. At one end is the ideal optimistic future where we solve all our problems and we live happily ever after. At the other end of this continuum is catastrophic collapse. Now, we have tended not to fill in all the spaces in between, but that's actually where things might be very interesting, because there may be some forms of disruption and crisis that will actually stimulate us to be really creative, and most importantly, will allow us to get the deep vested interests that are blocking change out of the way.
And that'll be part of what allows us maybe to have that values conversation.
Exactly.
Or prompts that values conversation. Let me tell you that you're listening to Free Forum on KPFK 90.7 FM, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, on the web at kpfk.org. I'm Terry McNally, and I'm speaking with Thomas Homer Dixon. He's the author of an earlier book, The Ingenuity Gap, which I recommend, and his newest that we're talking about now is The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization. You can learn more at www.theupsideofdown.com. All four words is one, theupsideofdown.com. And for audios of this or previous shows, go to temcnally.livedigital.com/content/audio. What role... let me just say one thing in response to what you just said. Before we went on the air, I said it sounds a little like we're more likely to allow what you just said, that it's going to take breakdown to really release what needs to be released and opened up, sort of, to save us. In an individual's life, oftentimes you hear that. People won't really change till their back's against the wall. They won't really change till they hit bottom. In the 12-step program, hit bottom and then ask for help. People aren't usually willing to say that about society because it's too frightening. But
it is basically the idea. In fact, I introduce it very much in personal terms. And I talk about exactly the kinds of things that you mentioned there. There are times in most of our lives where we've had a series of crises, and it's really challenged us in the most fundamental way. We've had, in some sense, a breakdown of the basic systems that we rely upon to manage our lives. And we've had to rebuild. We've had to think about what we're doing very carefully, re-examine our values.
Well, break patterns.
And often we've ended up much better off afterwards. Now, it's interesting. It turns out that when you look at the research on complex adaptive systems that's come out over the last 15 to 20 years, the most adaptive systems that we know of in the world all go through patterns of growth, increasing complexity. Eventually, they become rigid, they break down, and then they reorganize themselves and regenerate and regrow. All highly adaptive systems have breakdown in them at some point or other. The key thing, though, and this is where I think that Jared Diamond's argument just doesn't give us purchase that we need, is that we have to keep the breakdown from being catastrophic. There has to be enough resilience left in the system, enough information, enough adaptive capacity that things can be regenerated. If it's catastrophic breakdown, then recovery is often impossible afterwards.
Right. So in other words, you're saying let's be realistic and not fear to talk about breakdown, because if an intervention's needed, if things are that bad or about to be that bad or even become that bad, we've got to be able to deal with it and not be disempowered.
We need to start thinking now about what we're going to do in those occasions, because these will be times of frustration and fear and anger on the part of many people when things suddenly, fundamental verities and patterns of life are challenged. They'll be scared. And in those moments, extremists can take advantage of the situation and push our societies in directions that are very bad. And we need to be prepared, those of us who are non-extremists, to push in other directions and create something that's good.
Let me just make a reference. I recently interviewed Neil Ferguson about his book War of the World, and he quotes Franklin Roosevelt and Hitler, both coming to power in the midst of the Depression, and they sound so alike, and yet you see one of them...
That's exactly right.
One of them took it one way, and one of them took it another
way. In fact, that's exactly the example I use in my book, The Great Depression, because it was a crisis, it was a breakdown that challenged the fundamentals of the capitalist system. In fact, in the 1930s, a lot of Americans thought that capitalism was a failed system. FDR used the opportunity created by that catastrophe to rebuild the fundamentals of American capitalism, to change and to introduce a lot of Keynesian policies that laid the groundwork for American economic power for the next five decades. On the other hand, in Europe, that crisis was used by Hitler to generate one of history's most horrific regimes.
Right. And analogous or playing off of that, Lester Brown in Plan B, 2.0, he says that what should give us some hope is the fact that we can turn around our economies and our productive capacity on a dime as we did in World War II, and says we could make shifts in the way we deal with things and move toward renewable, cleaner, et cetera.
That's right. And yet, that turning on a dime occurred in the midst of a crisis. And it's not. And my suggestion is that we're not going to see these fundamental shifts until we have a crisis of some kind. Whether we're going to exploit them effectively will largely depend on whether we've planned well in advance and have thought through how we're going to mobilize at those critical moments.
We need to talk about this more. We've got about 2 minutes left. I'm going to give you those 2 minutes to say, this values conversation, what is the role of religion in this? Because right now, it seems to me it is not helping.
It should be helping, because our religious institutions are supposedly the places where we think about these larger values issues. But what happens when we go in the door of our church or our mosque or our synagogue is we're given a creed. We're told what to think, not given a space in which to have a conversation about these things. So one of the issues that I discuss at the end of the book is how we can create an environment, what I would call an open source democracy, using open source architecture, so we can have some of those really deep discussions about values that we can't within our current religious institutions.
So that's, in other words, you're saying that two things, if I get this. One is, or three. One, we're in bad shape. It's probably going to break down, not necessarily collapse, but break down. And it's going to be that breakdown that's going to give us finally the impetus to change, and it's value conversations. We're going to have to adapt our value institutions, politics and religion, to deal with that.
Whether we take advantage of those moments, what I call moments of contingency, effectively, will largely depend on whether we know where we're going. And we won't know where we're going unless we've had that values conversation ahead of time.
So the values conversation has to start now. And we've got to end this conversation, Thomas. We will pick this up again soon, and maybe we'll pick it up there and talk about the values conversation. This is one of those moments when I pine for the old hour I used to have. So again, the book is The Upside of Down, Catastrophe, Creativity, and the Renewal of Civilization. The website is www.theupsideofdown.com. Thank you to D'Angelo Jones, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi in production, Matt Perez in traffic, you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week. In the meantime, email me at T.E. McNally, T.E. McNally, at att.net, T.E. McNally@att.net. If you have questions or comments, or if you want CDs of past shows, or if you want to get on a weekly announced list in which I tell you who we're going to have on and what we're going to talk about. And as I said before, you can find audios of this and previous shows at temcnally.livedigital.com. And you can find an archive of this one for a limited time at the kpfk.org. website as well. I look forward to speaking with you again, folks. This stuff is worth reading, The Upside of Down. Thank you, Thomas Homer Dixon. Keep up the good work.
Thanks so much.